21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus & Company. This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. It's time now for award-winning 21st Century Radio. Here's your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Hot town, summer in the city, back of my neck getting dirt and gritty. Bend down, isn't it a pity? Doesn't seem to be a shadow in the city. All around, people looking half dead, walking on the sidewalk harder than a match here.
Hey, welcome back to 21st Century Radio. No, that song, Summer in the Cities, feels like it sounds. I mean, really. And you ever been up to New York City, especially in Greenwich Village during the summer? Well, that's how it felt. Well, welcome back to 21st Century Radio. I'm Dr. Bob Hieronymus. Our executive producer is Laura Courtney. Our engineer is Noah Dankner. Whoa, boy. Hey, by the way, great show as always from Mike Gerlach and Insight on Disabilities, a very important show on WCBM indeed. Well, on October the 15th, 1967, bass player Steve Boone took the Ed Sullivan Show stage for the final time with his band The Lovin' Spoonful. And since coming together in a Greenwich Village hotel in early 1965, Boone and his bandmates had released an astounding 9 top 20 singles, and, the first of 7 of which hit the Billboard Top 10, including the iconic Boone co-writes, Summer in the City, that you just heard, and You Didn't Have to Be So Nice. We'll talk about that one a little later on. Now, little did Steve Boone know that the path of his life and career would soon take a turn for the bizarre, one that would eventually find him looking at the world through the bars of a jail cell, and from captaining a seaworthy enterprise in order to smuggle marijuana into the United States from Colombia, to a period of addiction and to the successful reformation of the band he helped make famous. Hotter Than a Matchstick Head tells the story of Boone's personal journey, along with that of one of the most important and enduring groups of the 1960s. Steve Boone is a member and owner of the Lovin' Spoonful and performs regularly at concerts across Canada and the United States. He lives on the northeast coast of Florida. His co-writer is Tony Moss, and he's a senior editor at CBSSports.com in Fort Lauderdale, and is the author of A Season in Purgatory, Villanova and Life in the College Football's Lower Class. That's published in 2007. And he lives in Boca Raton, Florida. What a place to live. Welcome back to 21st Century Radio, Uncle Steve Boone.
Dr. Bob, did you do all that on one breath?
Yeah, just one breath.
I am so impressed. Well, what a guy you are.
Yeah.
It's great to be back with you on the radio, Bob. How are you doing?
About an A+, you might say, right about now. A lot of great stuff, especially your book, which I can't wait to talk to you about this evening. But, you know, Zoe and I are in this book, and I'm going to be selfish here for the first couple of questions here. I'm going to skip right ahead to those pages because I enjoyed them so much. Do you mind?
Not in the slightest, Bob.
Okay.
Not in the slightest.
On December the 7th, 1980, Zahara and I were to be married, and you had promised to play at our wedding. Why didn't you make it?
Bob, if I could have told you, you would have freaked out, and I knew that I had a chance of making it. There was nothing in the world when I looked ahead that was going to stop me, because, boy, if anything I wanted to keep was that date with you and Zoe. And, you know, the fortunes of the trade winds just blew the wrong way on December 4th, 5th, and 6th. And you know something, as you'll read in the book, there's an old sailor's myth that when you leave for a long journey on a Friday, look out for bad luck. And sure enough, bad luck hit us on Saturday night after we left on a Friday very early in the morning. So we didn't make it, but I sure did want to. I can tell you that.
What kept you from it? Tell us.
Well, we loaded up the boat off of Ocho Rios, Jamaica, with about 6,500 pounds of good quality Jamaican ganja, and headed off for the Windward Passage, which is the passage between Cuba and Hispaniola. We got some pretty headwinds on us. It was rough going. We were making progress, but not the kind of progress I wanted. And by the time we got into the Windward Passage and were headed more to the north, the winds increased. I could tell by my charting and dead reckoning on the chart that we were too close to the Cuban coastline for comfort. So I had my helms, and while I took my midnight break to catch some sleep, I had my helms and steer a course a little more to the east that would take us away from Cuba. And in doing that, though, that brought the wind more firmly on the bow of the boat, punishing it more. After about a half an hour of sleeping, Rick, my crewman, called me up. He says, "You better come up and look at this." And I'd already heard the banging on the side of the hull of one of the sail lines. And I ran up there, and sure enough, the stay, what they call the stay, the wire that holds the mast up at the front of the boat or the bow, had broken at the deck. The only thing holding the mast up from falling into the water was the flexible stay, or actually the luff wire, that's in the jib sail. And I knew then that we had big problems, because if I lost the jib, the mast was going to come down. It was the only thing holding the mast from falling down.
Let's stop there. Let's stop there, Steve, because we don't want to tell the whole story.
Okay.
Hey, we want.
That was why. And then we got an unfortunate decision that had to be made, and I made it. We sank the boat. Got picked up by the Coast Guard, got into the airport at Great Inagua, and it was December 7th, the morning of. I almost made it.
Yeah.
Almost made it. We hit Nassau that afternoon when you were just getting married, caught a flight to Baltimore that night. And ironically, as I walked from the gates to the flight to Baltimore, a pile of newspapers, John Lennon shot dead.
Yeah, that was a
tough
time.
Of course, on the 8th, so yeah. I guess that would have been a day later. So we were actually a day behind getting to your wedding, but I tried.
I know you tried. You never give up. I know that. On October the 30th, 1982, you asked me to officiate at your second wedding to Joan L. Ryan, and I remember telling you that very few that I have ever married succeeded in remaining together, and I didn't want to marry people anymore, but that didn't bother you. Tell us about that. That was a wonderful day, though. It really was. Tell us about that day.
You know something? When you talk about an Irish wedding, you can look it up in the picture book, and that wedding is the Irish classic Irish wedding. And Joe's family, they're a well-known, respected family in Laurel, Maryland. Her father had a Chevrolet dealership there, and they had a beautiful house out in the countryside. It was the first time my entire family had gotten together in a long time before that, and they all came together on a beautiful day. It was just as nice as it could be, and we had a great outdoor feast, oysters and crabs and all kinds of good stuff to eat. And Bob, I got to compliment you on what I thought was a really charming, beautiful ceremony. But you're right, it didn't last. It met, 3, maybe 4 years later, and we were Splitsville.
Well, I really enjoyed that day. I'll never forget that day. It was such a beautiful day in October.
Yes, it was.
And the wedding ceremony, we were using alchemy. We were actually using a formula of alchemy during that process, and no one interfered with what I was doing. I thought somebody would have said something. What are you doing there? Well, anyway, now, you had lost your bass, and later you learned also that you lost your gold records. Who stole your gold records, and how did Zohara and I relocate them and have them returned to you?
What a story. When Joe Nell and I separated, she went to the Virgin Islands to live, and I decided to head to Florida. She said I could stay at her mother's condo in Hallandale, so I packed up my car, got my Chesapeake Gruff in the car with me, and headed off. I did not have room, however, for my bass guitar. It was a Mustang. I didn't have room for my bass guitar, and my gold records were too valuable. I didn't want to pack them in and see them getting broken, so I entrusted them to a fellow that was an engineer at Blue Sea Studio, Mark Ritter. And he was living out in Joppa Town or in that area at the time, and he said, "I'll take care of them. Don't leave them in Joe's house because she'll sell them."
How ironic.
And how ironic it turned out to be, because he ended up selling them. And when I asked for him to get them back, he said, "Oh, they're in a storage locker." And, of course, there was no storage locker when I tracked it down. So the greatest story on earth almost has to come from what happened next. You know, I love those gold records, and the bass was irreplaceable. It was a one-of-a-kind only Fender jazz bass made only in 1 year. Nowadays, it gets five figures in a minute for sale. But the gold records were my beloved possession, obviously. And about a year later, I was doing a show on Zoe's radio show, and she asked me about the story, and I told the story about how Mark Ritter stole them from me and that I believe they probably ended up in a pawn shop. And about 2 weeks later, I get a call from Zoe saying, you know, I just got a call from somebody that heard our show, and he says that he's got your gold records. And I was like, I dropped the phone. I could not believe that. How small a world can it be that listening on a radio show, somebody would actually have been the guy that bought those records in a pawn shop? And then the double whammy was when I connected with him, when you guys hooked me up with him and connected with him, nicest guy in the world. He was more than willing to sell them back to me for just what he paid for them.
That's amazing.
And so that was amazing. I put a great mention and a thank you and, of course, paid him back for what he paid for them and autographs, the album, and some pictures, and had his picture up on the website. He was my hero because I finally got those gold records back. And thanks to you and Zoe and that gentleman, it just made my year, if not my decade.
Do you recall his name?
I think it was Dom was his first name. I don't have his last name comes to mind immediately.
I'll check that out when we take a break because I wanted to thank him on the air again. Now, here's the last one. It was my beloved wife, Sahara, who made sure that your Rock and Roll Hall of Fame statue stayed in your hands. How did she do that?
She had another one made up. And as an insurance policy, and then you guys held on to the original for me until I got settled down and in my personal life settled down and in my business life, the Love and Spoonful got back on the road again and things were doing good. You guys have been so generous with me over the years and have helped me out when I needed it, and that was really one of the finest things you could have done was to hang on to that icon for me. And I always had the one that you made up, but the safe and sound, secure one was in the custody of Zohara and Bob Hieronymus. And I thank you to this day for doing that.
But I got the backup now.
Yes, you do.
It's got a star at the top. So when we celebrate maybe your book signing, I'll drag it out. I'll carry it around like it's mine. What the heck?
It's and in a spiritual way, it is, Bob.
Yeah. Well, now we'll turn back to the beginning of your book and move more chronologically through your life. We can't answer all the questions I'm asking because there's 54 of them. This is such a good book in many different ways. I enjoyed it. I've read it twice. And you're going to be able, whenever I see you again, I'm going to take a look at it, and you'll see how it's scribbled on every page. It's kind of it's an encyclopedia of Steve Boone right now. Well, in the prologue, you call yourself a fan, unapologetic pot smoker. Well, why did you say that? Why are you?
Well, I think, you know, in a very short answer, because I could go on for hours, I think history is going to judge this era very poorly.
Yeah.
Of the folks and laws that locked up absolutely good, well-meaning, productive, patriotic citizens in a jail with violent and horrible criminals that should be in a jail and locked them up for, in some cases, life for having to do nothing more than getting intoxicated on a mild plant whose intoxication wears off in a few hours and is not as definitely not as dangerous as alcohol or tobacco, and yet alcohol and tobacco are totally legal. Marijuana is, you can get thrown in jail for a long, long time for even getting caught with a small amount of it. And so I thought, I've been using it for my entire adult life. Of course, I don't overuse it or abuse it, but it is not something that's going to cause any harm. There is no reason why somebody, personal consumption of something like that, should be against the law, and people should have to go to jail, perhaps treatment, but to go to jail and have your life essentially ruined for just smoking that is, to me, I think history is going to look very, very poorly on this period and for what this period brought on to people that were caught by that.
Yeah, I agree with you. The history is going to look at them in a very, very dark way, because there's the alcohol industry, cigarette industry, and a lot of politicians, especially friends of mine that were Republicans, were just opposed to telling everyone, basically, you know, this is worse than alcohol. Now, that well, they were dead wrong, and it's just unfortunate. Now, tell us a little bit about your family life, your mom and dad and siblings.
Well, my dad, very interesting. What a character he was. I mean, in a very good way, too. He was obviously my role model. He grew up on Long Island. He actually was born in Philadelphia, but his father was in the hotel business, and he owned a hotel out in West Hampton Beach, New York, out in the Hamptons. So he grew up out there. And I guess, you know, he grew up in the roaring 20s, so he was quite the guy. In fact, I wouldn't be at all surprised if he wasn't tossing some bottles of hooch on the beach when the Rum Runners were doing their thing back in the 1930s. So he was a very adventurous guy. He went to work for Franklin Roosevelt in the mid-1930s as an administrator at the Summer White House in Warm Springs, Georgia, an administrator at the foundation there where there was a polio rehabilitation center. And when the war broke out, he was, because he had already had a son born and was too old to enlist in the military, he used the influence from the office of who he was working for and got into the Marine Corps and served as a non-commissioned warrant officer during the war, came home, returned to the hotel business in North Carolina, in Southern Pines, North Carolina, and out in the Hamptons. And then my grandfather took another job in Pennsylvania where he met my mother, who was from the coal district up near Scranton. She was from Avoca. Her father was a coal mining engineer and a union organizer. And she was a great woman, too, a great lady, very, 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 very beautiful woman. And they married in Pennsylvania in the 1930s. Had my older brother Skip in 1936. I was born just after the Battle of Leyte Gulf in 1943. And my brother Mike, Charlie was born in 1946. My brother Mike in 1954. My brother Charlie was severely burned. And so to recover from that burning injuries, he had to move to a humid climate. So my parents moved us to St. Augustine, Florida, the most wonderful move I've ever made in my whole life. I say in the book I was delivered to paradise. And from there, my dad started a custom woodworking business, building custom furniture for people that wanted like a custom kitchen or a custom antique reproductions, things like that. Very multi-talented guy. He could do almost anything. He got me into sailing. He started the Optimus Pram entry-level competition sailing club in St. Augustine in conjunction with the Rotary Club there. Got me interested in a lifelong activity called sailing, and also instilled in me a strong desire to be in the Marine Corps. I was born at Camp Lejeune in 1943 at the height of World War II. I was christened by the base commander as the future commandant of the Marine Corps.
Whoa.
And my very first memory was two Marines in dress blues picking me up out of the crib and tossing me in the air. So my parents could not have been better influences on me. My mom for hard work and responsibility, and my dad for a myriad activities that I've used for my entire life and for the responsibility to be a good citizen and when the time comes to do what your country wants to do.
Well, your dad taught you there was more shame and failure in quitting than anything else. And I know you followed that advice the rest of your life. You mentioned it in the book. Now, you wanted a career in the military and even tried to enlist when you were 14.
That's right. Well, my parents announced we were moving to New York, and I thought, another winter? I don't think so. And I loved St. Augustine so much, and I had such a good life there with sailing and my paper route and all the things you do in the wonderful Northeast Florida weather and climate. So I hitchhiked to Mayport, Florida, where they have a huge Navy base, and tried to enlist in the Navy, and they told me to go home and get 4 years older before I come back.
Well, you note that in the hierarchy of rock and roll, bass is where you put the lame dude, the retarded friend. King kind of like the right field, as you note, in the Little League. And why did playing bass become such a blessing to you?
Well, that's a great question, Bob. And I answer it as briefly as I can because I could go on for hours. I'm a big believer in the bass and the drums roll in rock and roll. But when I first started playing, I learned how to play guitar because I was laid up from my horrendous automobile accident at age 16, which is the reason I didn't go in the Marine Corps. I was ineligible for military service. I had a paralyzed right foot and numerous injuries from a crash in 1960. But recovering, which meant I was on a couch for almost 18 months. My mom bought me a Gibson acoustic guitar, and my older brother Skip, who was already playing in rock bands by that point, would come by every day and show me a new chord. I would listen to WKBW radio after midnight, where they would have Dick Biondi, and he would play the newest rock and roll before it would hit the mainstream charts and the ABC and WINZ. He would have it on the air, so I'd listen to his program, learn all the songs that were coming off, and then when I just graduated from high school, my brother Skip asked me if I would come in and fill in the band with my acoustic guitar, and I said, but Skip, nobody will hear it, and he said, that's fine, I'll hear it, and I want to hear a rhythm guitar, so I started playing rhythm guitar, and to tell you the truth, as well as I can strum a guitar, I've never been able to be comfortable with playing lead lines, so within a month of me playing in the band, and I bought a beautiful Les Paul guitar so that I could be electrified, the bass player, who was in the Air Force with Joe Butler, announced that he was retiring from the Air Force and moving back to Louisiana. And he pulled me off to one side and said, Steve, I think you're more a bass player than you are a guitar player. And I got a month before I leave, I can show you what you need to know. And I tell you, I absorbed it like a sponge, Bob. It was like this was the instrument I was meant to play. I loved it from the first minute I started playing the bass lines. And my first attempt at being a musician before the accident was on a drum kit.
We got to stop there, and we'll come back a little later on to the drum kit. But also, you had said many times you never wanted to sing a lead song, and one time you were actually pushed into it. And when we come back, we're going to play an example of that, Priscilla Millenaria. This is 21st Century Radio. I'm Dr. Bob Hieronymus. Our guest is Steve Boone. And right now you're listening to Daydream from the Lovin' Spoonful.
And I'm lost in a daydream, dreaming about my bundle of joy. And even if time ain't really on my side, it's one of those days for taking a walk outside. I'm blowing the day to take a walk in the sun and fall on my face on somebody's new mowed lawn.
Hello there, this is George Martin, and you're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
If you wanna be a girl of mine, you got to bring it
Wild About My Lovin', Wild About My Lovin'. It's on the Do You Believe in Magic album. Adapted from a traditional jug band favorite, this song set the tone for the folkier side of the Lovin' Spoonful's music. Would you like to say anything about that song?
Oh, absolutely, Bob. You know, when I met John and Zolly, they were both very, very interested in doing rock and roll. But, you know, John whipped out some of these what I call chestnuts from the folky and folk blues era. And Wild About My Lovin' was the first one that got my attention because John would sing it in a very laid-back style, almost behind the beat, but not really. And most rock is sung either ahead of the beat or right on the beat. And when he sang Wild About My Lovin' just playing the guitar, I could hear what he was trying to speak as to a vision for our future. And I could say, man, put a bass and drums to that and keep that behind-the-beat singing that John's specialty is, and I think we're going to have a unique sound. And that's why Wild About My Lovin' to me is really the harbinger of what the Lovin' Spoonful would eventually evolve into, and I think it shows in how it sounds.
Well, one of the things I like about your book is you are really honest. You don't hide from saying who you are and what you're doing, even your limits. And that's the reason why I noted, and I thought that that was really important for anyone's biography. I'm in a process of writing mine, and I'm having a hard time with being absolutely 100% honest. But you mentioned time and again that, look, you never wanted to sing lead, but sometimes they kind of forced you into it. And one of them was in this Priscilla Millionaire. How do you pronounce that one?
Priscilla Millionaire.
Oh, yes, on the Everything Plain album. And this is your only attempt at a lead vocal on any Lovin' Spoonful album. Let's just take a little listen to this, and why you said this is the reason why I don't want to take leads. Okay, tell us a little about this song here, Bill. Bill, Steve.
It's okay, Joe. no, listen, that song could have been a hit if John had sung it, or Joe, or Jerry. Any of the three of them could have sung it. But you know something? John wanted me to sing it. He almost insisted that I sing it. And I got this wild idea. They sent us to music lessons when we first got together, voice lessons, not music lessons, and it was a disaster. The guy tried to teach me and Zolly how to sing in a classical style. And my biggest problem is I don't hear pitch well. So whenever I get a song that has anything beyond an octave range, I strain to hit the note, and I'll go flat most of the time. So I just stay away from singing leads. But on this song, it was the kind of song that you can hear that it's sung in the old rock style of ahead of the beat. Mm-hmm. And I thought that I was going to be able to sing it, but I thought that it would really come out sounding real cool if I just drank a pint of banana liqueur before I finished it.
Yeah, that'll do it all right.
And that really, that put the icing on the cake on that one. And so you can tell as the song goes on, you can almost hear me getting drunker. So,
well, thank you for being so upfront and honest. I mean, that's what, when people get this book, they're actually going to be hearing things that they never would have heard other people, especially other rock and rollers, expose themselves to. You got a lot of courage there.
Well, you know, Bob, what have I got to lose, really, you know? And not only that, I agree with your premise that very few people put it out there, you know, warts and all, for people to read. I mean, nobody is perfect. I mean, I don't care who they are. They all have something that is not quite up to par. And I figured that if I'm going to write a memoir, if I'm going to be honest with the folks that are going to read it, I might as well just tell it how it was, how it is, and how it's going to be. That was my motto.
Well, there's another song that I'd like to go right to, producer. This is called, this is on the Forever album. Actually, it is Forever. This is a beautiful instrumental piece. This is written by Steve Boone and arranged brilliantly by Jerry Yester, and I enjoyed meeting Jerry. And let's take a listen to this, and let's talk about it afterwards, okay?
All righty.
Very nice. Really, very nice. Tell us. Go ahead.
Jerry's brilliant. Jerry's brilliant. He's just one of those guys that's got more talent in his little finger than I have in my whole body as far as music goes. And he just did a brilliant job with arranging a very simple piano piece that I wrote. So, you know, as much of the credit that comes to me belongs to him, too, as well on that. It's a beautiful piece. And you know, Bob, that had its roots in the fact that Zolly and I, as you find out in the book, were busted for pot out in San Francisco. And the outcome of that bust was a horrible, horrible direction that our lives took, Zolly and me. And the sad part was is that nobody else really understood or knew the depth of how, especially for Zolly, because, you know, his father was a communist in Canada, and his whole young life was shadowed by investigations and informers, and his father being an active communist, member of the Communist Party. I'm sure that for what he had to do, or what we had to do to get what the authorities wanted us to do in that bust, was I say in the book that the Lovin' Spoonful was a fully active band for 1 year, 1 year only, from 66. From May 26, 1966 on, the air was slowly going out of the balloon that said Lovin' Spoonful plays here. And Forever came about as, like I said earlier, a piano piece that I would sit down and play, and I never really had any lyrics for it. It just always struck me as an instrumental. And when I played it for Jerry as we were recording the Everything Playing album, by that time Zolly had left the band under a very poor circumstances. And I just felt terrible. I was in as low a mood as I could possibly be in, and so that song reflects my mood.
Mm-hmm,
and Jerry brought enough life to it to really give it a genuine feeling of uplifting, but in a manner of, like, get yourself off the floor kind of uplifting. And so I think it's a beautiful piece. And ABC used it in Wide World of Sports for its entire length 1 year. On their Saturday television show. So it's had some recognition, too, otherwheres.
Well, it's not only, that's not the only song that's been used by TV and movies. As a matter of fact, do you think we have enough time now to do Butchie's Tune? Yes, we do. Listen to Butchie's Tune. And my producer is saying, oh, yes, this is the B-side of Summer in the City single. And Butchie's Tune was written by our guest Steve Boone, was featured in the cult favorite movie Blow Up, directed and produced by Michelangelo Antonioni. Then, in 48 years later, it closed the end of one of the most popular Mad Men television shows. Just listen.
Please don't stick around to see me when I'm feeling low. Don't pass the cards to me to deal the crushing blow. So you won't see me go when I'm leaving. Gone today, I'm on my way. I'll walk away like a shadow in the night. I won't give cause for you to feel we have to fight. I'll make it easy so that.
Whoa, very nice. Tell us about Butchie's Tune.
Oh, Joe did a tremendous vocal on that. And, you know, John Sebastian admits, and deservedly so, that Joe had the most naturally pure voice in the band. He's a great singer, did a wonderful job on that. Butchie was a gal that I met very early when the band was first getting together in the basement of the Hotel Albert in Greenwich Village. Butchie had a permanent room in the hotel, and she was married, had been married to Bob Denver. Of movie fame. And, of course, Gilligan's Island is his most famous television show. And she was living in Greenwich Village, and she was a friend to the band. And I never had a romantic relationship with her, but we kind of were like real good buds, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And when the band's finally got on its feet and was earning enough money to have our own places, we all had to give thanks to Butchie, because she not only fed us and put us up when we couldn't pay our rent. She could stay with her. She just was a great gal, friend of the band. And so when I wrote that song, I think she had kind of a warm spot in her heart for me. And like I said, we never did become romantically involved, but I wrote that song with Butchie in mind. And it says a lot, and it doesn't say anything specifically. It sort of says a lot of generalities about relationships and how you can say goodbye without ending the relationship.
Well, that's exactly what we're going to do right now. We're going to say goodbye without ending our relationship, and we'll return.
Oh,
with
that
our...
sounds good. I'm glad to hear that, Bob.
We'll return with our guest, Steve Boone, bass player for the Lovin' Spoonful, an inductee into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in the year 2000. Hotter Than a Matchhead, My Life on the Run with the Lovin' Spoonful with Tony Moss, ECW Press, lovinspoonful.com, steveboone.net.
Do you believe in magic in a young girl's heart? How the music can free her whenever it starts, and it's magic. I'll tell you about the magic and the free of soul, but it's like trying to tell a stranger about a rock and roll. If you believe in magic, don't bother to choose if it's junk and music or rhythm.
Hi, this is Remance Eric of the Doors, and you're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Listening to Night Owl Blues, the Night Owl Blues. That's on the Do You Believe in Magic album, I believe, and it's an instrumental blues jam featuring John on the mouth harp and Sal on lead guitar. And that was your set closer on the Night Owl Cafe, where the band began its history in Greenwich Village.
I always say I love that, Bob. Good for you.
Tell us a little bit about this song. Boy, it's really something.
You know, John Sebastian is an unheralded, well, he's heralded. People know he's a great mouth harp player, but he's one of the best. Just an outstanding, and he's got the genes for it. His father, John Benson Sebastian, was a world-famous classical harmonica player. So John grew up in the lap of a lot of very, very positive musical influences. And when John whipped out that mouth harp at our little jam session that me and him and Zolly had before the band was even formed, and we just jammed on some blues with him playing mouth harp, I said, man, this guy is special. And that song, Night Owl Blues, was how we would close every set at the Night Owl Cafe, and the audience would go wild.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you a quick story, Bob, and I have to make it quick because I know you want me to move along, but when we did our Hall of Fame performance, they wanted us to sing Do You Believe in Magic and Make Up Your Mind. And at the rehearsal, I knew John's voice wasn't up for the, it wasn't good for the performance. And I said, John, let's do Night Owl Blues. It will knock them off their seats.
It sure would.
And it would have.
It would have. Yeah, I agree.
They wouldn't let us do it. They wanted a hit record. And as you know, the Hall of Fame performance didn't come out quite as good as we'd hoped it would.
Yeah, but you were right on that one. Boy, that would have just blown them away. That would have been another world that they never even knew existed, frankly. Now, how did listening to Bob Dylan and Lenny Bruce inspire you to write your own songs?
Well, it very strongly. Lenny Bruce was the first person I hear understood. I had heard comedians before that were making social commentary, but he was the first person that used humor as social commentary that I could understand. When I first heard his album, one of those fantasy 33 LPs, 33 and a third LPs, all in red, and it was just great. He would lay it on the line, all the social issues of the day, but he would do it humorously. And Bob Dylan, before Bob Dylan, all of my rock influences, and I loved all 50s rock, don't get me wrong, but all the songs were basically boy meets girl, girl meets boy. They get together, they love each other, and it all skip off into the sunset. There was, or it was comedy songs. There was very little in the way of, except for in some of the country music, Hank Williams and people like that. But in rock and roll, nobody was putting in songs with more of a message than boy and girl get together and kiss and all that good stuff. So when I heard Dylan was doing it, and Lenny Bruce, on the other hand, was making an entertainment statement about social commentary, it made me go like, you know something, I can do this too. I just need to learn how to marry the words with the music so it doesn't sound like you're reading a poem. Because that doesn't work with rock and roll. You've got to have it be hard-hitting and fast-moving. It can't be like you're reading a poem. So then I meet John Sebastian, and he's already 1 year ahead of me on the songwriting thing, and he's got these techniques that he used for marrying up verses with choruses. And, of course, his lyrics started to touch on more important subjects. And my first song that he and I wrote together was a song that I thought had a lot of social commentary in it. Even though it was a boy-meets-girl song, it had a very strong, important meaning to it. And, of course, that song was You Didn't Have to Be So Nice.
Yeah.
And I think we're going to play it later in the show.
We sure are. We'll play it next hour for sure. Yeah.
So we'll talk more about that then. But that, there are two influences. Bob Dylan married social commentary with music. Benny Bruce married social commentary with humor. And the two of them together married Steve Boone with writing songs. And I always felt strongly about social influence and the impact that songs and rock and roll have on young people. So what better way to get their attention than to write a song with some meaningful words in it?
You got that right. Now, how did you come to play bass for Bob Dylan, and what songs did you play on?
Well, that was a great story. You know, when the band first got together, Joe Butler didn't want to. He already had a band he was working with in the Village and had a manager, and they had a record company interested in him. So the drummer for the Lovin' Spoonful, for the first gig that we did, was my older brother Skip's drummer from Florida, Jan Buettner, whose drum kit I had tried to learn how to play 5 years before that. And he was the manager of a summer-only hotel out in Bridgehampton, Long Island. And it was closed for the winter, and he said, you guys can bring your instruments out here. I have my drum kit here. We can set up and play all day long. So for a 10-day period, we went out there, and the three of us, Zolly, John, and me, and Jan Buettner, that was his name, and we practiced the very first rehearsals of the Lovin' Spoonful at the Bull's Head Inn in Bridgehampton. And then, about 7 days into the rehearsal, the phone rings, and somebody asked for John Sebastian on the phone, so I hand him John the phone, and he goes and talks to somebody sounding very familiar. Yeah, yeah, I can do that, I can do that. And so he puts the phone down, and I say, who is that, John? He said, oh, it's Bob Dylan. And I went, yeah, right, it was Bob Dylan calling you up. Little did I know that he knew Bob Dylan, and being a Village brat as he was, you know, a hanger-outer in the Village as Dylan was, he knew them from people just hanging on the street. And so he said, yeah, he needs me to play bass on some recordings he's doing. Can you drive me into the city? And I was the only one with a car, so I said, sure, let's hop in the Austin Healey. We headed into New York City. I took my bass with me, just because bass players never left without his bass, and John didn't have one. So we get to the studio, and there is Bob Dylan. And, you know, we've got to tell you, this, I'm not somebody who really gets blown away real easy, but walking into a room, and there's the Bob Dylan that had these big hit records. And he wasn't a real big guy, but he cut an imposing figure. And so right away, he couldn't have been more friendly. He asked John to play these four tunes, and they tried, John tried at it, and John's not a bass player. Bass playing is a unique gig, and so after trying for about an hour, John said, why don't you give Steve a crack at it, because I'm not getting these parts. And so Bob said, look, just play what comes into your head, feel the beat. There was already a drum track down, so all I had to do was play bass with the existing drum track. It was an overdub, and I played on Maggie's Farm, Positively 4th Street, and one other song. I played on three cuts, and I can't remember what the third song, but they were all on the Bringing It All Back Home album. And Maggie's Farm was the only one that my playing got used on. Now, if you go to the online chat rooms where people that know everything about everything are, they will say that, oh, there's other bass players involved. And, yes, there were other bass players on that album. But when I listen to Maggie's Farm, I have a unique style. All I have to do is close my eyes, and I can remember me playing every one of those notes. So I'm absolutely positive that I played at least on Maggie's Farm and maybe on Positively 4th Street.
Well, then Dylan invited you and John later to listen to a song he was very, very excited about. What was that?
Well, you know, he came to a show, and he actually invited the whole band up to his apartment in Gramercy Park. And we went up there, and he stick an acetate, which is a test pressing of a record, on the record player. And when those organ notes first hit, and it was like all of a sudden, you know, like a Rolling Stone came rolling out of the speakers. It was, man, I was blown away. I said, man, you've got a monster hit, but you're going to have to cut it in half. It was like almost 7 minutes long. And, you know, at that time, AM radio did not play anything longer than 3 minutes. That was it.
Yeah.
And so I said, you know, Bob, and he, for all you want for my opinion, I think it's a brilliant piece, a great-sounding recording, and I think you're going to have a hard time getting it to be a hit because it's so long.
Yeah, but you...
I'm sticking with it. So he did.
You're stuck with it. Hey, well, we got to take our break here at the top of the hour with our guest Steve Boone, bass player for the Lovin' Spoonful and inductee into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in year 2000. Hotter than a match head, My Life on the Run with the Lovin' Spoonful with Tony Moss, ECW Press, lovingspoonful.com, or go to steveboone.net. And the song we're about ready to hear is Nashville Cats.
And it was Nashville Cats, Plain Plains Country Water. Nashville Cats, Plain Bob's Mountain Dew. Nashville Cats, been playing since they's babies. Nashville Cats, get work for the children.
Stimulating talk around the clock. Breaking news now on Talk Radio 680 WCBM Baltimore and WCBM.com.
Fox News Radio. I'm Lisa Lucero. 14.